It's the poker tournament every player wants to win, the WSOP main event. Not only does it come with millions of dollars, it's the only tournament that awards the title of poker's world champion. I'm Robbie Straczynski, host of the Cards Chat podcast, and I spoke with seven of these world champions: Phil Hellmuth, Chris Moneymaker, Greg Raymer, Jamie Gold, Joe Cotta, Ryan Reese, and Martin Jacobson, to find out what it takes to win the main event, what happened next, and what advice they'd offer to new players. We have the pleasure of welcoming 2003 World Series of Poker main event champion, Chris Moneymaker. Was poker stressful for you?
No, it was always a hobby for me. It was never poker. I mean, I've been very fortunate. Poker's never been a stress for me, because back when, before the World Series main event, it was just a prop. It was just a hobby, something I did for fun. I mean, I loved playing poker. I would play poker for 60 hours in a weekend. When me and my friend Bruce, that talked about earlier, we would go down to Tunica, and we would drive down there. We wouldn't get a hotel. We would stay the whole weekend playing, and we would, basically tag team drive back 4 hours back to Nashville, because we would stay up all night playing the entire weekend. We just loved playing poker. It was fun. It was something that we just enjoyed doing. So, and I was actually a profitable player from the beginning because people were so bad. And then you take that, and then my first tournament's at the main event, kind of won that. So, when you add both of those together, right, it's always been profitable for me. So, I had a question that I always remember. A lady asked me, she's like, yeah, I play in poker tournaments, but then I'll go play $1,000 buy-in, and I lose that $1,000 buy-in, and it bothers me for a week. Mm-hmm. It affects me for a week. I get really frustrated, and, that's really financially a big hit for me. She's like, what would you say to me, like, to get over that? And I was like, don't play $1,000 buy-in. It's going to affect you for more than a couple hours. You don't need to be playing it. So, right. Anything, the bankroll management is a thing for a reason. You should never stress when you're playing poker. Now, granted, almost every poker player I know has gone broke playing, over their head or doing something they shouldn't do, poor bankroll management. But as you get older, you learn not to do that mess, and you play within your means. And the quicker you learn that, the better you're going to have a time playing poker and the more fun the game is going to be.
How did you put some of the players on those hands, especially players like Amir Vahedi?
Well, poker back then was a little bit simpler than what it is today. There wasn't a whole lot of training materials. There wasn't a whole lot of evolution in the game. And back then, especially like in my home game, my home poker room, they had actually written on the rule, checking and raising is not allowed. You couldn't check it. One of my biggest strategies back then was to play in position, and if people checked to me, I bet, and I would take it down a lot of times. And that was my strategy almost for like the first 3 days. It's really sad, but that's all I had to do.
Right.
Because people generally would bet when they had it. And, there was a lot of donk betting. There was a lot of leading into pots when people had things. So, back then, ranges weren't really a thing. You put people on specific hands. I mean, this guy has aces, ace king, or nothing.
Right.
I mean, that was the ranges. So you're playing with someone like Amir Vahedi, for example, who plays the moon. He plays every combination of cards, mm-hmm, is what he would do. You would have, someone like that, or someone like Howard Lederer, who only played aces, ace king, really premium hands.
Right.
Amir Vahedi was a very active player. So obviously, if you're an active player, you're going to have air a lot. And the other thing that people did back then that I picked up online, and this was sadly so far ahead of the time, is bet sizing errors. When you're playing online, that's all I ever focused on was bet sizing, especially on the turn. Not so much on the flop, but on the turn, someone's bet sizing always gave away the strength of their hand.
Right.
And you could see it in the World Series. People would, vary their bet sizing drastically on the turn based on their holdings. And they weren't that crafty with it back then. Mm-hmm. It was just an error. And we've learned, and we've gotten better as a game. But, yeah, it was something that I definitely capitalized back in back in 2003. So
awesome. Amazing. If you could turn back time, would you do anything differently after you won the WSOP? Did you make any mistakes in handling the worldwide love and media attention?
I would change a lot. I don't think I did any mistakes as far as like handling how I handled things from a personal standpoint, from like doing interviews and doing all that. So I think that all was fine. My biggest problem is right after I won the main event, my second tournament I played, I got second in, which was a WPT event. Mm-hmm. I ended up getting second place to Phil Gordon. Mm-hmm. And when you start your poker career, winning the main event and getting second in a WPT, you kind of feel like you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately breeds complacency. And I didn't study the game of poker. I didn't focus on trying to improve for many years. And I didn't play a whole lot. So for the next couple of years when I was playing and I was getting beat, I was making runs, but I wasn't like winning tournaments. I wasn't, you know, getting in the money a whole lot. I would blame a lot of it on bad luck. You know, my mm-hmm. aces were getting cracked, or it was all bad luck. And it wasn't the fact that everybody's getting better. Instead of getting three bet with aces, kings, and ace king,
right?
Now I'm getting three bet with queen five, mm-hmm. and I'm getting exploited. And I didn't see it. And it wasn't until, I want to say almost a decade later, maybe not that long, but it was probably like 7 or 8 years that I was playing on PokerStars, and the guy who was ranked number one or two in the world at the time, I want to say it was Sean D, but I'm not sure, but he's of that ilk. We played a pot and I had ace king. We were deep in a 5K event and he four bet me all in with queen five.
Hmm.
And I thought at the time, this is the dumbest play I've ever seen. I won the hand, I eliminated him, and I'm like, what the hell? But I knew who it was.
Okay.
I knew he was a phenomenal player.
Right.
And even though I won the hand, I eliminated the person, I still was like, why?
Right.
I mean, you're not the number one player in the world doing that, or number two player in the world doing that without a reason. So it actually woke me up to the fact that I'm getting abused, mm-hmm. and not seeing, because if I have like nines there back in the day, I'm probably folding.
Right.
I'm over folding too often to four bets because I'm putting them on too high of a range,
mm-hmm.
and I was being exploited and I didn't realize it. And that was me being complacent. So if there's one thing I could go back and change, it would be to study the game of poker earlier on. Again, the problem I had was poker was so easy back then.
Yeah.
Just print money. I could teach someone to go play poker in 2 hours, send them to the casino, and I'll guarantee they'd make money. Wow. Poker was just easy. You could print money. If you weren't making money from 2003 to 2009, you shouldn't be playing poker.
Right.
So I was still making good money, but all the elite players were getting so much better than me, and I didn't see it.
What is the best way for a new player to study poker for free? That's an interesting one.
Well, if you want to do it for free, the best way is going to be on Twitch. I mean, I don't really know of another free venue that you can actually go out and watch poker from really good players that will answer your questions in real time. They'll tell you what their thought process is. I mean, Twitch is an amazing platform for poker, and it's something that obviously if it was around 20 years ago, it would have been a really nightmare for me. The amount of poker knowledge that's out there right now is phenomenal. You can find poker training sites, really good ones for really cheap, you know, $19.95 a month, $40 a month, you know, they're all different price points. But if you're looking for strictly free, I would send you the Twitch streets. So that's where you can go. You know, you have to probably dig through a bunch of stuff, but if you pay attention, take note to what some of the good streamers are doing, then you know, find one that, you know, fits your style. I mean, you might see someone like Lex who plays one way, or Spraggy who plays another way, and maybe you fit more into Lex's style. See what he's doing in three bet pots and what he's raising with, what he's raise folding with, why is he doing things, ask questions. And that's honestly, and he'll answer the questions, and so will Spraggy. I mean, that's what they're doing, is they're educating players for free, essentially.
Fossil Man Greg Raymer, welcome to the Cards Chat podcast. I'm kind of wondering, maybe you could tell us all a little bit here about your poker playing during that 8 to 9 year stretch. How often did you play, and were you often playing in tournaments, or were you just, you know, mostly cash games? What was it like, sure, you know, those years prior?
Well, I had been playing poker seriously for about 12 years mm-hmm. before I won the main event. My first job as a lawyer, I was in Chicago, and I kind of randomly found the Rockford Charity Casinos. Sure. So that's, they were out, you know, and the max bet is $10 under the charity laws at that yeah. time. And I'd been looking for blackjack games and found that, but it was like, oh, wait, I can't make money counting cards with a $10 max bet. But they had poker, and I had played with friends in college and stuff, you know, and of course, none of us had a clue what we were doing. You know, we were really horrible poker players, but it had always been fun. And so I kind of played for fun on this first visit. And it was kind of like someone says something about pot odds. And I'm thinking, like, what's that? Never heard of that before. And I went to a used bookstore, bought three books. Two of them were kind of, you know, they were entertaining, but not useful. But the third was The Theory of Poker,
okay,
by Sklansky.
Yeah.
And so I was very fortunate that that was, you know, basically my first real resource to learn how to be a better player. And I was just going back to the Rockford Charity Games playing 3-6 limit. And then I took a job in San Diego, was there for about 3 years, mostly playing in Oceanside. But occasionally I would like ride up to LA for the day because there was a tournament going on at the Bike or the Commerce or something, and was growing my bankroll. That's when I started doing the fossils and got the nickname. Uh-huh. And, you know, I was playing maybe 10-20 limit. You know, occasionally I would take a shot. They had a pot limit hold'em game in Oceanside when uh-huh. I lived there.
Oh, they don't see and that I would game take, spread that often anymore.
Pot it was like hold'em. It was like either 2-5 or 3-5 blinds, and the minimum buying was only $100.
Wow.
Wow. And, you know, so I take a shot at it for $100 every now and then. That was like my first big win, was like winning like $2,200 or $2,300 in that game.
Nice.
Like I came home late at night, like 3 a.m. My wife's asleep and I wake her up by like sprinkling $100 bills onto her, you know, and she's waking up. What? You know,
I love it.
And I'm like, look at all this money. You
know. That's awesome.
But then I took my last job as a lawyer working for Pfizer in Connecticut. So I was near Foxwoods. Mm-hmm. I would play there, and they had a great tournament, no limit hold'em tournament every Tuesday night. And I used to win that thing like 3, 4, 5 times a year. Mm. Nice. I'd be entering it like 40 times. You know, I'd be winning it maybe close to 10% of the times I entered. And the field size was like, wow. It would start off like 50 to 100 when I first moved there in 98. And then it got to the point where there'd be 200 or even 300 people.
Right.
And I'm still winning it several times a year because people right. were really bad at poker back then before the poker boom.
Right. And not just cashing, winning the tournament. That's pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, none of that stuff was on Hendon Mob.
Right.
And I don't have like the exact records of every time I played that tournament, but I would guess that if I made the final table, I probably won it 60% of the time that I got there.
Wow.
You know, because it was just, people just played really bad back then. Mm-hmm. Is really the main answer to it. But so I was playing cash. Like I would go Tuesdays and I would play that tournament. I'd go either Friday or Saturday, play cash. Again, I'm building up my bankroll more and more at this time. And by the time I won the main event, my main cash game at Foxwoods was 75-150 mixed.
Nice. Games. During your run to the WSOP main event title, at what point did you believe you were on a special run?
Never did.
Really?
Again, it's a scientific answer. Like, huh. If you had asked me at the beginning of day one, are you going to win? My answer would have been like, well, I don't know if we knew the number yet of how many entries, but assuming we did and there's a little over 2,500, mm-hmm. I'd have been like, well, I'm better than average. So maybe it's 1 in 1,000.
Okay.
You know, and if you'd asked me again later, it's like, oh, you've doubled your starting stack now. I'm like, well, maybe it's 1 in 50 or 60,000.
Really?
If you'd asked me when Heads Up started and it's like, oh, I have 70% of the chips against David, I might have said, oh, I'm a 3-to-1 favorite to win it all.
So at no point did you feel any like, I've got this as my day, momentum, fairy dust from the sky, nothing like that?
No, no, I definitely don't feel that way. Because, again, I'd already played enough poker by that point that I had gone from, you know, big stack to next guy out. And I'd gone from short stack to winning the whole thing. And so I knew that none of this is written in stone. And so it really was just a like, well, what percentage of the chips do I have? And then if I think I'm above average in skill, then I can size that number up a little.
Okay.
You know? But if you have half the chips and your average skill level against the remaining field, it's 50%, whether that's one opponent or 10 people. I mean, if you have half the chips, you know, with 11 people left, you're not any more likely to win the whole thing than if you have half the chips heads up.
It's a very rational and grounded unless you have a,
unless you have a skill advantage.
Right.
Right. Okay. You know, if you're better than the remaining opponents on that skill level, then you have more than 50%. But it's still, it's all, you know, you start with the chip count. And so at no point did I ever think this is mine, it's destiny.
Do you think you get enough credit for how successful you've been at the WSOP, or is that overshadowed by the fact that you won the main event?
I would say I probably don't get enough credit in some regards because I don't have a second bracelet. Like, in other words, it wouldn't have mattered really how much money I'd won, or even if I'd had a, you know, 50 final tables instead of just 50 caches. I think people still might say, but you haven't won a second bracelet. But overall, I've done well. I've certainly made a lot more money than I've spent in buy-ins at the World Series, you know, since winning the main event. Not counting that 5 million, just counting since then, I'm sure I'm still ahead quite a bit, you know, at least a few hundred thousand, if not more. But I, in my own opinion, I've underperformed. I don't think I've, I certainly, if you'd asked me like in 05 before the series started, like, oh, if you're still playing every World Series, you know, for the next 15 years, how many bracelets do you think you'll have? And I would have said at least 3 or 4 more.
Really?
Okay. So I do feel like I've underperformed at the World Series, even though I've been making money. I mean, like the closest I came to a second bracelet was a stud high low tournament. And this was a year where they actually had an exceptionally bad structure for the limit games. That was a year they did the double stack. There was one year at the World Series where we did double stacks. So you got two tournament chips for every dollar of the buy-in. And this was a $2,000 buy-in, I believe, stud high low. And we started off playing like 20-40 limit in level one. Like I won practically, I mean, I won like half the hands. I won every hand I played. And my 4,000 chip stack was like, you know, still under 6,000.
Wow.
You know, just crushing the table. So it was kind of an irrelevant level one. And by the time we got to the final, like we were four-handed at the final table. I had 15 blinds or 15 small bets.
Wow.
And I had half the chips. and you know, and it was just like I get a guy all in and I have like two pair to his one pair and, you know, and two more cards to come. And he like catches boom boom and wins, and then the same thing happened a hand or two later to someone else. It's like, oh, I've got kings up on fifth and you have a pair of sevens, and instead of making your low draw you caught another seven. And then it's like, well, and then all of a sudden I'm on fumes, and then I, you know, get it in my last couple of bets in good and lose that one. And it's just like, well, shit, like I just had this thing crushed. I had half the chips, you know, I basically had 50% of a bracelet in my hand and then just a couple of ordinary beats. And it wasn't like my opponents were like, oh my God, you're an idiot for not folding. It's like, no, it's like they're starting off with five bets and, you know, they're getting a perfectly defensible hand.
Maybe that's just the way the hand plays out. Exactly.
The one big lesson I think you can get from poker once you understand the game well enough is that you have to kind of ignore the results. You know, it's like, was this a smart decision? Yes or no? The fact that you then won or lost the pot is not really directly connected to how smart the decision was. Right. I mean, if you go all in and I call with two aces and you beat me, that doesn't obviously mean, I mean, it's pre-flop. Obviously, I wasn't supposed to fold. But I'm still going to lose some percentage of the time. So that result doesn't mean anything. And so that's, I think, the important part is that learning to completely dissociate the result from the process. So that's like, let's focus on the process. Let's focus on making smart choices. Mm-hmm. And that applies to everything else. Like, you know.
Joe Cotta, welcome to the Cards Chat podcast.
I started getting my first live experience when I was 18. There was an Indian reservation that I would, you know, travel to and play. Just, it was smaller, but it was fun to play, you know, go up north and visit my friends at college. It would be at Central Michigan and then just play at the casino there. And I got my live experience there. They had some decent games and some tournaments, like the, I think it's the MSPT would go there and stuff. And then when I was 19, Canada was close. So it was like a 45-minute drive and they had a good 10-20 Nomax game. And that was some good experience. I made some good money in that game. And by the time I was 21, I had a decent amount of experience live and I had a ton of experience like just online. So I felt comfortable playing live. Yeah, going up to the World Series, I mean, I had like the plan of playing everything on my own and just playing a lot of the events. But then I got approached by one of my good friends, Tony Gargano, who I played with online, who, you know, we would lean on each other and talk to each other about hands and stuff. And he played bigger at 10-20 online. He asked me if I would be interested in being back because he was backed by Sheets and Backs and they had a big stable and they were interested in backing me for the World Series. And I thought about it. I'm just like, you know, tournaments have a lot of variance and, you know, it can get real expensive out during the summer. And do I want to, you know, spend $100,000 on tournaments and, you know, go over the, you know, I know it's possible. So it was like, okay, I could play cash on my own out there and just, you know, get free rolled in these tournaments. And, you know, if I win a lot of money, I'm okay with getting half. And if I lose a bunch, it's not like, you know, again, it was one of those things that I always try to be responsible in terms of like never risking too much of my bankroll on a certain thing. Like I bought a house, I paid taxes. I had a few hundred thousand in the bank. Like I didn't want to risk like 100K of my like 500, you know, on the first series out there. So I got backed and it was basically a full schedule of 2500s, 1500s. And I had a few runs. I remember 1500, like a week or two before the main, there was like a few thousand players. I was down in the final 20 some players. I'm like, wow. All right, this is my shot to win a bracelet. Like, this is my only chance. Like these fields are so big in these hole events. Mm-hmm. And I still remember the hand that knocked me out. It's kind of funny. I was third in chips at the time. And Elke was second in chips. And this was when Elke was winning everything. Everyone knew who Elke was. And it was blind versus blind hand where I had jacks, where I raised and or he raised. I three bet from the big blind with jacks. He four bet and I jammed and he had ace 10 and he called it off and the flop came all spades and I had the jack spades and he had no spade in his hand. And it was for a chip lead pot on. It was such a huge spot for me. And the river just came the red ace. My dreams were crushed. I was like, all right, I'm not winning braces this summer. I was like, kind of like devastated, but cash was going so well for me out during that summer that it really didn't bother me too much. I was doing really well in the 10-25 games. I was mostly grinding. Mm-hmm. And I guess the main event is just, I got lucky with the table draw and ran super hot the first day.
Right.
And just coasted the whole way. It's weird. I guess just being comfortable always in terms of financial, and I've never looked at money as like what I can buy or how meaningful it is or how like big this spot is. So even like during the main event final table, it was just like kind of just I looked at it more as a game and always a game and just how do I win at this game and what's the best way to approach this game. And the money has never really felt real to me in a way. It's I don't know, maybe that's helps me like just not be attached to it and make the right play and not be fearful of the outcome. So, but you know, you learn from your mistakes as well. And I think it's just comfortability, just playing so much and having so much experience and being in those spots. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think motivation is a tough thing. Like I noticed like my competitive Spirit was kind of took a backseat. I remember just when I was a teenager, when I was 20, I just played all the time, played, put in the hours. I was so determined to be really successful at poker and prove everyone wrong. And it was like, I didn't fear anyone at the felt. Like I would sit down and it wasn't like a bum hunting like mentality. It was like, okay, you know, let's go. Like, if you want to play, let's go. I'd sit down at the heads up tables. I'd play anyone. I wouldn't dodge anyone. And it was all about getting better. And then after winning the main event, I realized like, now I'm flying, traveling more. I'm going to these destinations. I'm not putting in the hours. And then when I am home, you know, I'm doing other things and, you know, enjoying other parts of life. And it was more of like, now I have more of a sense of a balance. When I was like a teenager, when I was 20, it was just like, I almost played an unhealthy amount where I couldn't keep putting in those that same time. And it didn't feel the same after winning that kind of money too, because it's like, why am I putting in this much time for, you know, this amount of dollars? And I never really cared about money. I never wanted to like see how much I could accumulate. It was just about, you know, making a good life for myself. And now once I won the main event, you know, that already happened. And so now when I go back and play poker, I don't have that same like, okay, I'm gonna play anyone. I'm gonna, you know, let's go. It's like, okay, these guys know a lot. They've been playing nonstop. I haven't been. So now it's like I play 6 max. I'll probably play smaller than I did before, 5, 10, 10, 20. But it's just like I play because I really love the game. I enjoy the game. I'm still successful with it, but I'm aware that, you know, there's really good players out there, and I'm not the same player I used to be in terms of the time I'm putting in.
We have the pleasure of welcoming 2013 World Series of Poker main event champion, Ryan Reese.
So at the time, I was actually still going to college. I was a senior at Michigan State. I was preparing to graduate in December. So that was 2 months before I graduated. And it was funny, I was working. I was a poker dealer at the time.
Right.
So I was dealing, and I didn't have a lot of money at the time at all. I think this is kind of a crazy story, but before this tournament started, I had $2,000 to my name, and the buy-in was $1,675. And, but I was working, and I was doing pretty good as a poker dealer. Like back then there was a tip cup. So there was like a little cup on the table. And when someone would win a pot, they would just throw chips in there. Since then they got rid of that for like the charity poker rooms in Michigan. But sure, when they had that, it was very lucrative to be a dealer.
Right.
So I had like a good couple weeks dealing. One of my friends was like, hey, do you want to drive to Chicago and play this poker tournament?
Right.
And if you look at my hand in mob, I had no cashes before that. I played a few tournaments.
Exactly.
But I was never successful. And I was like, sure. So we drive out there. I finished work at like 11 p.m. And then we had to drive 4 hours to Chicago, and the tournament was the next day. So we get to Chicago like 4 a.m. All the hotels are sold out. So you can't get a hotel anywhere. It's in Hammond. So like there aren't many hotels nearby anyways. And then all the ones that were there were sold out because this is a huge circuit event. So we end up just playing blackjack from 4 a.m. until noon when the tournament started. So I have my $2,000 to my name, and I just buy in with the whole thing at the blackjack table.
Wow.
And I actually got down to $100 of that money and then spun it back up to 2000 and then stopped and was like, okay, I need to take this money to play. Because if I would have lost that last $100, I wouldn't have even been able to play the tournament.
Right.
Because I didn't buy in yet or anything. So, yeah, I got really lucky to even be able to play. And then the tournament went great, and we ended up chopping. We ended up actually chopping it 3 ways. They didn't really facilitate it back then, so there's not much of a record of that. But the tournament, so it started, the day 3 started at noon.
Right.
And we had to finish the tournament that day, but the structure was really slow. And guess what time we finished?
2 a.m.?
7:30 a.m.
Oh, my God. Wow.
From noon. So like, and they wouldn't do anything. Like everyone's like they're like getting rid of all the tables. Like everyone's like ready to like, they have flights to catch. Like people had to leave.
Right.
They wouldn't let us chop it. They would let us chop it, but they wouldn't like facilitate it. So like everything we have to do on the side. And then we didn't, the players didn't know each other, so you have to like trust the people that they're not going to steal from you and stuff. Wow. But yeah, really, really crazy story. That's kind of how it all started. And then I graduated from Michigan State and then just started playing full time. It means a lot, to be honest, because like in the beginning, I just won the main event. And then the couple years after that, I was playing like really high stakes, was playing like 100Ks and 25Ks and stuff. And I wasn't that good at the time. I thought I was really good, but like I really wasn't that good. So to like kind of get out of that phase and still be, and then be able to like kind of get back to where I can compete on the highest level. It was, it felt really good because like I said, like right afterward, it was tough. Like I kind of just, I won the main event. So I'm a 23-year-old kid with a lot of money. So I just jumped right into the waters with all the sharks, with all the best players in the world playing really high stakes, and it didn't work out. And then I kind of took a step back. Started playing like lower stakes, like still like relatively high stakes, but I wasn't playing 100K buy-ins anymore. And then I was able to really work on my game and get better. And then I was successful. I've never been a big study guy. It was mainly just playing and also just maturing. I used to be like kind of crazy, like on the table, like my play style, I would just bluff like way too much. And so kind of just like calming down and not trying to take every spot, not like, I was just really crazy. And so really just like, yeah, just like calming down and taking it more seriously and not splashing as much. Cause when you have like a lot of money and you're young, you can kind of be careless. And I felt like I was doing that to some degree. And then you start to lose a lot of money and you're like, okay, hold on. I gotta reevaluate this. So
we have the pleasure of welcoming Martin Jacobson. So you're playing recreationally, you're playing as a hobby, and then you somehow you win a seat into the 2008 WSOP main event. Now that's a big deal for anyone, you know, especially, you know, recreational players. That's the dream. But you weren't necessarily sure if you're gonna play or not. So let's hear that story from you.
Yeah, so that was in 2008. So I finished military service and I was working at a restaurant in Stockholm, still living at home. I continued playing, you know, the late schedule after I finished working. And then in the summer, I managed to win a seat to the WSOP main event. And I was only 20 years old at the time. And this was back where you had the option to either take the money, $12,000, I believe.
Right.
Or go and play. So it was, of course, a bit of a dilemma. Mm-hmm. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Of course, I wanted to go and play. But at the same time, I was being realistic and perhaps that wasn't the sensible thing to do. I mean, probably not, given that I had no experience playing live tournaments or like multi-table tournaments.
You've never played?
No.
Oh,
apart from like a few like home games and stuff like that. Like so I played on some poker clubs.
Sure.
Wow. Yeah.
Right onto the big stage. My goodness. Okay. Yeah. That's okay. I can see the dilemma. Yeah,
$12,000. Just to put it in perspective, we're working as a chef. You really don't make a lot of money, especially when you're young and up and coming. Like I was basically working for minimum wage.
Sure.
So $12,000 was almost like a year's salary.
It's a lot of kron. It's a lot of kron.
A lot of.
Right. Okay. So that way, but then you go ahead. So you play, unfortunately it didn't work out too well. I'm not going to kick doors. I will say this. So you made the decision, you decided to go and play. Three hands later, the dream is dead. It's not great, but, and this is the reason I'm telling you, we don't focus on the negative here. A month later, right, in August 2008, you finished second in the PokerStars Sunday Million for $89K. A couple months after that, you turned an $800 satellite into a third place finish at EPT Budapest. You know, you made a deal, 280,000 euro. That's your first live score. So the reason, again, I brought up the WSOP within a few months here, okay? You started as a recreational player. You're playing on the big stage. It didn't go well. And then all of a sudden, a couple months later, you have two massive scores. What does it feel like at the end of those 3 months after you've experienced, you know, the highs, the lows, the roller coaster?
Yeah, it all went so fast, actually. you know, from winning the main event seat, I won it super late. I won it in May, so it was really not a lot of time to even decide what I was going to do. And busting third in the WSOP main event, getting second in the Sunday Million just a month later, and then qualifying for EPT Budapest and managing to get third place. Yep. So it was, yeah, a big roller coaster, but like a very fun one because poker was so new to me and it was, I was so passionate about it. And yeah, it was sort of like a dream come true, even though I don't know if I viewed it like that. I never actually made the decision to go pro. It was just sort of something that happened.
Interesting.
In between two jobs, I quit my job in Stockholm to go to move to Barcelona and work at a Michelin star restaurant there. And I had everything set up. So, well, I hadn't spoken to the person there, but a girl that I was working with in Stockholm said that she would set it up for me. Her friend was there and they needed more chefs and I could rent a room there. And like everything was pretty much a done deal.
Sure.
So I quit my job and then she quit as well. And then for whatever reason, I couldn't get a hold of her. Like she just went MIA. I still haven't spoken to her today. it's the one of the weirdest things that ever happened to me.
Wow.
But I wasn't like panicking or anything because I knew I could always get another chef job. Like that was
right.
It's one of those things that it's there's always a shortage of good chefs. So I could always get a job if I needed to. I was living at home, so I didn't really have many expenses. And I was enjoying playing poker. So that's sort of what I did. I just continued to up my volume and play more and study more. And that's sort of when I started having success. I got second in the Sunday Million.
Right.
And then I managed to qualify for Budapest. And then, you know, and just sort of carried on from there. I never really looked back.
That's amazing. You say you never really made an active decision to go pro, but to me at least, you know, I imagine many of our listeners, you know, here in the Cards Chat community, one of the main differences between being a recreational player and a professional player, sure, you know, as a recreational, you still want to win, you take it seriously, maybe you do a little bit of studying, but as a pro, you're studying all the time. So at what point did that sort of change where you say, okay, well, I want to take this more seriously, and besides playing more, you also started really getting in the lab?
I didn't really get into the lab until way, way later, to be honest.
Huh.
Back then, I don't think it was very different poker back then. Like, I think it's important to point out, no one really knew how to play, like myself included. Everyone was sort of like trying to figure it out because there really wasn't that many resources available.
Right.
Like now, today, we're spoiled. Like there's software that tells us the answers. We just plug in some numbers. Like there's charts for everything. Like that wasn't the case back then. It was really hard to get any sort of solid information. Like this was in 2008 when I sort of went pro. So I was sort of learning as I went and just learning from experience. I was reading a few poker books. That was sort of like how I studied.
Sure.
And then the rest was just talking strategy to friends. So I when I start traveling, you sort of meet more fellow pros or that are in the same position as me, have like similar experience. Maybe some of them had a little bit more. So I learned a lot from them, just talking strategy to them, but also playing and like seeing what everyone else was doing and like thinking about it, and then just, you know, kind of copying, you know, what I thought was good, and then trying to differentiate what I thought was bad, and then sort of develop my own playing style just from that. I've always relied a lot on my friends in terms of growth. I think it's really important to have a good support group or like close knit of friends that you can talk strategy to and like sort of explore different strategies, and also just like motivate each other and keep each other accountable for to progress. Mm-hmm. So I've always sort of done that, but like maybe never really to the extent that I did to prepare for the final table.
Right.
Because that, you know, like what's going to motivate you more than that opportunity. So I really went 100% all in. Sure. The best extent possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the strategy that I came up with, that I was just going to speak to all my friends, like everyone I had, I was close with, or whose game I respected, and everyone's really happy to help. And because I think they could put themselves in my shoes. Obviously, like none of them have ever been in that spot. Like it's really hard even for a professional to make the November 9. It's such right. a small, such a long shot that it really doesn't happen often. Mm-hmm. But everyone could sort of relate to the situation I was in. They could put themselves in my shoes. They knew how big this was.
Right. We all dream about it. Even people like me.
Everyone dreams about
being on that stage for sure.
But no one really prepares for it because right. it's so rare. Mm-hmm. So like I never prepared for it. So I was like, what should I do? So I just started brainstorming first on my own, but then I created a Skype group with 30 of these friends of mine.
Wow.
And we all sort of like bounced ideas and we're brainstorming together. And that's sort of how we came up with you know, the idea to play simulations of the final mm-hmm. table. I started writing player profiles on every player, every opponent, their tendencies, researching all the hands I could find on them. Apart from, you know, preparing myself mentally and like meditating and,
right.
and, you know, doing yoga and keeping myself in great like physical and mental form.
We have the pleasure of welcoming Jamie Gold.
I've been playing my whole life. I grew up first in Manhattan with my mom and my grandparents. And my grandfather was a gin rummy master. And that's really how it all started. Since I was maybe 3 years old, I was really into cards. And I would sit on my grandfather's lap and he would play every Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday.
Wow.
And it would be, you know, all his weekends, you know, really just his free time. That's the thing that he loved to do the most. And it was such a great education. And I'm sure that that's where a lot of my card sense kind of came from. And yes, my mom also taught me a lot. And we were very competitive as a family in a very friendly way, but competitive. And so we would play a lot of games and a lot of cards and not always just for matchsticks.
Okay.
we not that I, you know, had a bankroll, but whatever I, would be given, I was certainly happy to risk because there was, you know, as a child, there's no real risk with anything. And people, I'm sure, started out by letting me win. And then right. that really bothered me. I really did not like to be given, you know, that kind of, you know, generosity, let's right. say, from them. But it was not fun for me to win if I wasn't truly winning.
Like
and
that.
So, yeah, I, over the years, I moved out to New Jersey when my mom got remarried to my dad, and it's yeah, it was so much fun. We would play, you know, through middle school and high school, and I have some really great pictures of my friends who would remind me that, do you remember taking all of our money during, you know, in high school? And I just want to give it back to everybody, but I you know, was I took it a lot more seriously than my friends. I remember in summer camp as well that we would only play we had candy back then, right? You would go to the canteen and you would have, and our parents would send us, we'd each have a trunk full of, you know, candy, and I would end up with everything by the end of the summer, but I also would then just share it with everybody, because, you know, it's what other way is there? And so my friends from summer camp would also remind me that about us playing poker, and that I took it a little more seriously than everyone else. And so I wouldn't say that I was better. I just cared more.
Right.
And so it was, it was an interesting life and always part of my life. And I loved the game, and it was something that I had always wanted to get better at, but there was not a lot of opportunity. I'm sure you remember back when there were maybe two or three books.
Yeah.
If you're talking about, you know, 30 years ago,
sure,
maybe not even, maybe one. And so there wasn't much ability like they have now to learn every single thing there is to know about the game. And there was no internet. There were no videos that people had created about it. It was something that I had only heard about the World Series of Poker from watching the movie Rounders. I didn't know there was a World Series of Poker. And once I saw that, you know, that movie and that idea of a World Series of Poker just kind of hooked me.
Yeah.
And from the moment I saw Rounders, I remember telling, you know, one of my best friends, who's now a business partner of mine, that, and who I went to college with, I remember saying, you know, I'm going to train and go and win that thing.
That's so cool.
They, you know, just said, yeah, sure. Everyone thinks that. And that is true. Everyone does think that. But I'm a little more competitive than most people.
So it's,
thankfully it happened on my first shot and I didn't have to spend my life chasing that. Not that there's anything bad about a life of, you know, with a goal in that way. I'm just so thankful, because it would have taken away from so many other things, because my focus would have been on that, you know, maybe solely, who knows?
Right.
And I like to do, you know, I love poker. I'll always be playing poker, but I also love doing a lot of other things in my life. And I never wanted poker to be the one and only focus that I had. It's just not for me. For some people, it makes them very happy, but I never had the ability, you know, or just the kind of mind that could just go and play poker tournaments all year. It never satisfied me. I gave myself 1 year where I was not working and I was just focused. I kind of took a year off. My dad was sick. You know, he had ALS, and it just, you know, made sense for me and my family that I would just focus on something selfish, because all they ever saw was me taking care of artists and as an agent and a manager. And I was working a little bit in production, but really much more of a representative of artists. And I was working nonstop, and I wasn't taking vacations. I wasn't taking time off. I was getting burned out, and my dad and my mom, they saw that it was killing me. And so before he passed, it was really important to him to see that I would focus on something just for me for once. You know, I was now 35 years old. It was just maybe 34. It was just time that I had to make a change in my life. And so I did it for myself and for them, but it was certainly the best thing that I had ever done up until that point, to try to, you know, not focus so much on everyone else, but to focus on myself. And so poker was my favorite thing to do at that time. So I said I would give myself 1 year and I would just truly get engrossed in the game and learn as much as I could and try to figure out a style that nobody had really used before, because I was never going to be able to be the best player in the world. What could I do that people would not be able to understand well enough? So kind of, you know, a little bit of the Jedi mind trick and some neuro-linguistic programming. And I would study a lot of the things that had nothing to do with the game of poker.
Right.
It was more about psychology, and they didn't show much of that on TV, which, you know, is fine. They showed what they needed to show to make it look like anyone could win the World Series of Poker, which is great. And it was really good for the game. But if you saw what was really happening, it's I had to figure out a way to win within the rules that wasn't just about the, you know, playing the best poker.
Right. And I think that's we call it speech play today. And then I think that was
speech play. And look, I also got very, very lucky, and things went my way, and I didn't get unlucky when I needed to, you know, I would put it in with the best of it and not getting unlucky.
Right.
And also had a certain skill of, I kind of knew where I was, and I was able to read people's hands. And so a combination of luck and working really hard at it and creating a way of playing that people weren't used to. And, you know, I was also just kind of in a zone, and, you know, sometimes you just get yourself into a certain kind of place where you're almost seeing what the cards that everyone is playing, and you can kind of navigate your way through 9,000 people. So it's, I don't know that it will happen again. You know, I'm sure I'll try, and I'll refocus on it again. But I'm really thankful that it happened on my first time going to the World Series of Poker, trying to win the World Series, trying to win the main event. You know, it was my first main event.
Right.
And it really, I just got so lucky to that everything kind of worked out that way. And I do think that all players should learn all styles, so that one, you have that in your kind of, you know, in your bag of tricks, let's say, you should always be changing gears and playing in different styles, but also learn everyone's style so that you'll see it when it's happening to you. A lot of what you want to learn in poker has nothing to do with how you play. You need to learn how everyone else plays. And that's why the game changes every year or two, and players are playing so differently now than they used to play, that if you just stay the same and play the same style, which people think Phil Hellmuth is just playing the same style as he always has. I disagree. I think he is always adjusting his game. He's just not necessarily learning from new players, because he doesn't have to learn from new players. He is so, you know, dialed in and tuned into his own evolution that he just has his own style and his own way of doing things. And it obviously works.
We have the pleasure of speaking with the one and only Phil Hellmuth.
I do remember the first time I played in a casino. It was, I hope I get this right. Let me just think about this. Well, I think the first time I played with a very famous actor named Telly Savalas.
Oh, wow.
I believe that was the first time I ever played poker. But I went to the Dunes Hotel and Casino, which is now gone, and there's a small casino there now called the Bellagio, not so small. and I remember, you know, I remember I was 21 and a half, and I'd been kind of a professional poker player, although I didn't know what I'd been a college student, and I had about $18,000 to my name, which was amazing. You know, we're talking about, you know, 1985. And, and I was like, this is amazing. That's all the money. That's a lot of money. and I remember saying, all right, it's time to take the next step. I'd crushed the games in Wisconsin for a year, year and a half, 2 years by then. And so it was time to hit the big time. And the first place I landed was the Dunes. Now, I hadn't done any research. I didn't know where to go. I just booked a room there. I do know this. I did not need that room for the first night. I don't think I used it for the first two nights. So I paid for the room for three nights. I believe I sat down in a game on New Year's Eve And Telly Savalas was on my left. And I'm like, oh, my God, he's one of the biggest actors in the world. He was the star of a television show called Kojak.
Sure.
And so, you know, but they were playing a game that I really hadn't played before. It was seven card stud, eight or better.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't particularly good at that game. And I remember playing, I believe it was close to 40 hours straight. Wow. And I went to, when I finally went to bed, I remember I had to be up in 5 hours to go to stay at my friend's house. My friend was Thule Haromi, but that's a whole nother story.
Uh-huh.
And, but I do remember this, that they knocked, they couldn't wake me up. And they figured out what room I was in, and security was knocking on my room, and finally security opened my door. And I mean, I think after being up 40 hours and sleeping 3, 4, 5 hours, I was just, and I'm a guy that, you know, always needs 9 hours of sleep. So
sure.
They couldn't even, I mean, they had to come into my room to wake me up. So yeah, that was my first experience in Vegas. Not the best start, but pretty glamorous, and that it was New Year's Eve, and Telly Savalas had a tuxedo on. So if we just stop there and say, wow, do you remember the first time you went to a casino? And I say, yeah, New Year's Eve, Telly Savalas, he was in a tuxedo. Wow, it was so cool to play with a superstar. I mean, I guess the standard answer was when I had two black nines against Johnny Chan. I remember, I'll tell that story quickly. The blinds were 5 and 10,000, and we were heads up. And I opened for 35,000, it's 3.5x. And Chan called the 35 and raised 130,000 more. And I was like, wow, what's going on? And I just thought, he's just changed styles. I mean, that's just a power raise. So I folded the A7 of diamonds. I wasn't sure, but I didn't study long. I'm like, well, he probably has me beat. There's no future. I can't call. And I remember four hands later, I looked down at two black nines. And I made it third. It's almost the minute I saw the hand, I was like, all right, I'm going to make it, you know. So I opened again for 35,000. And he went ahead and raised 130,000 more. And I just knew that I was moving in. I knew when I made it 30, if he re-raised, it was going all in. Unless I saw something in his demeanor, which scared me. Like, you know, the signal that he had aces or kings or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, that would signal my mind based on a read. And so, you know, and so he made it 130 more, and I just said, all in, instantly. And, you know, he had 650,000 in front of him. So he had to call off what? Well, he had 600,000 in front of him. So he already had 170 in there. So he called the last 430,000 with A7 of spades. And, you know, ESPN was there. And, you know, and that's only half the story. You know, the other half is that I asked, at that point, I had 100% of myself. No one had a piece. And I asked, and I'd watched Johnny hit his cards, you know, in the four biggest tournaments in a row, the World Series in 87 and 88 and the Hall of Fame main event in 87 and 88. He'd gotten it in with ace 10 against ace jack, and he kept hitting his card. And so it was such a huge disparity, 750,000 for first and only 300 for second, that I had to make a decision for my financial life. And we made a deal to save 150,200. First of all, I was 2.5 to 1 favorite to win the hand. And I remember we went outside to talk, and then Jack Binion came running over. The press is talking. What are you guys doing outside? And Johnny looked at Jack. I didn't know Jack. And he's like, oh, nothing. We're just making a save. And Jack's like, okay. Let's get back in. And we went back in. And I looked over at Johnny and I said, it's a save on. And he said, he said, yes. I said, all right, the save is on, 150,000 to 100. So in other words, I would get 450 if I was second place.
Right.
And 655 if I was first place. But until that second, if they just dealt the cards, I would have won the whole 755, which in the history of the main event, not many people have had 100% of themselves.
Sure.
And, you know, and I just remember, you know, there were a bunch of famous people in the stands, famous poker players. The stands weren't big, but there were some big names there. These people just wanted to say they were there.
Wow.
And you know, and the flop came down, you know, king 10, and then a queen. And I remember thinking to myself, man, I'm 2.5-to-1 favorite, just like I was before the flop, but only one to go. And I was expecting him to get there. Now, he would have had 1.2 million, but I would have still had like 600,000. So I knew I still could win it. So I was like preparing for him to hit the card, to not be stunned and not do something stupid, because by then I'd already played heads up a couple times for tournaments. And you can't let one unlucky card, you know, put you into shock. You can't be in the Masters tournament and, you know, make a triple on the second to last hole and then double the last hole because you're so shaken and it costs you the tournament.
Of course.
And when the six of spades came off, my hands went shooting up into the air. Now, you can go online right now at YouTube and you can see my hands shooting up in the air. It looks like I'm looking at the camera in the ceiling, but I'm looking up. After two swings, I turn around to look for my father.
Wow.
I have to stay out of view for 3 days.
Wow.
He's running up the aisle and security stops him because we had, you know, all the money, all the cash was on the table.
Sure.
No, let him through. I wave him through and I gave my dad this amazing hug. You know, there he was, you know, the best moment of my life to that point. And supporting me, you know, a guy who hated the fact I was in poker, a guy who didn't want me to be in poker, saw me win the main event, and the hug he gave me, you know, was just one of those lifetime great moments.
Do you miss anything about poker from the pre-moneymaker days, the pre-moneymaker boom?
I don't miss it. I mean, it was a great era. But, you know, there weren't as many players in the tournaments. All the great guys, we didn't travel together, but we'd all be in the same place at the same time, whether that was Atlantic City or London or Vegas or L.A. Those were kind of the, you know, the main places we would be, of course, Vegas and L.A. And, you know, when I went into a room then, it just seems like you knew 30 or 40% of the players. And that was nice, but the prize pools weren't as big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like this era more where, you know, where I can charge $50,000 a night for appearances, where I can write New York Times best-selling books, where I can be live in front of the whole planet, whether it's on CNN with Anderson Cooper or on ESPN. And so, you know, this is, I'm loving this era.